It is time for David Tarachuk with the Media Beat. David joins us every Friday here on Robin Hood Radio, or just about every Friday. And we rebroadcast David on Monday following the 12 noon news, also over the course of the weekend, but live here on a Friday morning. And he is joining us once again from afar. Good morning, David. Good morning, good day. Hello.
Hello. Hello. I'm not reporting as normal from the media capital of the world, New York City. I'm reporting, as you know, from what the old Irish folk song calls Dublin's Fair City, where the girls are so pretty. All the boys are also pretty, if we want to avoid being gender specific. I'm coming to you from Dublin on a sunny and cloudy day. We're getting a mixture of both.
Are you there, David?
I'm here.
Okay. You just dropped out there on a mixture of, and then boom, we lost you for a second. But
The mixture we're getting is sun and clouds. So nothing as bad as you're having in Connecticut, but it's a dull day, but it's got the occasional bit of brightness, which is what we all need, right?
Yeah, I'm not going to call this bad weather. I mean, you know, this is a, you know, hey, we can live with this. I can live with this. I know that I can live with this. But now, let's get on to the fiasco that is the world looking at America right now.
Well, the fiasco is America. The fiasco, I think, is America. Or at least that's the European attitude to it. It's being called a mess. It's being called all sorts of pretty shocking things. That's no surprise, because I think Americans themselves must be feeling pretty shocked by what's been going on in their nation's capital.
Well, it's not, you know, it's not only in the nation's capital, and that's the whole thing. I mean, with these threats against all 50 state capitals, possibly, it's sad to see, but it was like what we lost after 9/11. We lost thousands of lives. There was no doubt about that, and we lost a bit of a false self security we had in the world, as the rest of the world had dealt with terror bombings on and off for many, 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 many years. But what we lost after that, when the Patriot Act was put into effect, a lot of what we assumed that we had, we no longer had. We no longer have free telephone conversations, whether it's on a landline or whether it's on a cell phone. There's a lot of rules and restrictions that have come about because of 9/11. A lot of them has proven helpful, some of them not so helpful. But now, after what happened at the Capitol, they're putting up in an incredible area is being guarded by non-scalable walls that are people can't knock over and can't climb. I guess sooner or later, if somebody wants to really hurt themselves, they can try to climb it. But it's an area that encompasses almost 30% of the immediate area of Washington, D.C. And I've got a feeling, David, that those barriers are not going to come down for a while.
I think you're probably right, and the view from Europe is one of a considerable shift. I think the scenes coming out of Washington over the last 7 days have certainly made the world think again about the United States. I mean, it's been something of a truism for decades that America, whatever the comings and goings there may have been, America was still regarded as a beacon of liberal democracy. And now you get a newspaper, a prominent European newspaper like The Guardian, which has a huge readership in America too, but it's saying that it's no longer a beacon of liberal democracy. But now I see a Guardian headline saying that the United States is now the focus of global instability. That's quite a change. And also, you know, just at the level of prominent government officials, the Secretary General of the NATO alliance, of which, of course, America is the leading member, Jens Stoltenberg, said that what was coming out of Washington was shocking. That's the kind of language that the Secretary General of NATO would be sending to countries like Belarus or Venezuela in previous times. But actually, the fact that I'm in Ireland lends a certain perspective. And one of the things I should say about the Irish media is that it's not as excitable as some. It's certainly a lot more level-headed and a lot more commonsensical, if you like, than many media. It's one of the many things I like about being in Ireland. My fellow media operatives have a straightforward, level-headed approach to things. And I want to quote to you something from the Irish Times today, saying over here that we've been tempted, they say, the Irish, to swallow the dubious assertion that what happened at the Capitol last week was a serious attempt at insurrection. It's a word we keep hearing coming across the Atlantic. It was no such thing, says the Irish Times. It was just a riot, though dangerous for those in the building. It carried little credible threat to the existence of U.S. democracy. So it was, however, and this is where the Irish level-headedness comes in, it was, however, an abhorrent and physically dangerous burst of public disorder incited by the United States Commander-in-Chief, which I think is a pretty sensible way of summing up the situation.
You know, it's funny. Jill and I were talking a couple of days ago. I wouldn't have. I, people say coup d'état. It's not. It was not a coup. What was bad about it? It was a planned protest, which is fine. People can protest their support and their disappointment in the outcome of the election. There's nothing wrong with protesting like that. But the thing that really was the key here, and why it was not a coup. It was an attempt to stop an action by the U.S. government, the House and the Senate. It was an attempt to break up and stop the official tallying of the Electoral College votes. But that is not a coup. There was a, let's put it this way, these forces attacked the White House and taken over the White House and then taken the president or the vice president hostage. All of a sudden, then the word coup could start to come into this. But to me, this was just a riot. It was abhorrent because it is the first time that the Confederate flag was ever flown inside the Capitol. There was a lot of things, a lot of pictures and a lot that came out of this that were absolutely horrible. The deaths, the beating of the police officers, the protester who got shot, the woman who was so strong in her belief that it was a failed election that she tried to break in, and she was unfortunately in the wrong place at the wrong time. All those things are true, but what the Irish media is pointing out is absolutely true as well. This was not a coup at all. It was trying to put a throw a wrench in the works of the United States government, but it wasn't an attempted takeover. That might be on the horizon, who knows, but that wasn't what happened. It was an abhorrent scene. It was almost like, I think to people who follow the Pope, when the Pope got shot years ago, just something that that came out of left field that you didn't expect. And I think that's the whole thing about this. Nobody expected.
Except that they didn't accept, you're quite right, but there was plenty of reason to expect it.
Yep.
There was plenty of evidence that something of that kind was precisely what was planned. And if anybody paid any attention to social media of the right-wing chatterboxes, you would know that something of that order was going to happen. And indeed, you know, that's some of the post-event analysis that's going on. The FBI is now making it pretty damn clear that there was plenty known about what was about to go on, what was about to happen. The analysis and recording of the chatter that went on in the right wing populist settings was enough to indicate. And again, to revert to how it's being seen in Ireland. The fact that it was more of a wrench in the works than an actual coup doesn't actually make people forget the worrying signs that there are alongside what actually happened on Capitol Hill itself. I mean, the fact that pipe bombs were planted at party headquarters is the sort of thing which certainly gets the Irish media's attention. The Irish know a lot about bonds. Three decades of violence here. And the awareness of what kind of damage that can do to a society and to a democracy. They were quick to report that the FBI are putting up notices now appealing for witnesses to who may have planted a pipe bomb. So all of that was, all part of the mix. And again, not a coup, but worrying, and certainly something that needs to be addressed by democratic forces of law and order, which, of course, is what America has historically been proud of asserting very firmly, the rule of laws, not of men. And that's what we're facing now. And Europe is commenting on it in a range of ways. But as I say, the Irish commonsensical way is to say that it's not a coup, but it certainly is disturbing. And right-wing populists throughout Europe, I should make this point, have been condemning what went on too. These are right-wingers in places like populist right-wingers in places like Germany or Holland. Normally, very very strong in expressing support for Trump, have been very quick to condemn his followers who took part in the Capitol events. And those in power, those of the same persuasion in power, like Viktor Orban in Hungary, have been remarkably quiet about it all. So that's the scene as it's described here in Europe.
You know, as we sit here, and the thing that sits with me is, once the inauguration is over, and let's say we're in the middle of February, like I said, the thing that remains with me is that our Capitol building will be surrounded by these fences. And it wouldn't surprise me if more and more of these fences over the course of the next year are put around other monuments in Washington, D.C. And it's one of the things that you can't prevent. Once something happens, you want to try to prevent it from happening again. And so the government is going to try to protect the Capitol and obviously the White House a little better. But it's still one of those things that's going to linger when you're an American and you view upon the Capitol and it's surrounded by 8-foot non-scalable fence. That is not a sight that we're used to seeing as Americans.
That's right, and it's one of those changes which is unlikely to be reversed. It's like air travel after 9/11 changed forever, and it's unlikely to go back to the way it used to be. And I think the protection of public buildings, particularly capital buildings in state capitals and the nation's capital, are likely to be a feature of our life from now onward, and that's not likely to be reversed.
Is the rest of the world, not the rest of the world, but our major allies, are they holding their breath until after the inauguration, or they are?
Well, that's it. That's exactly what they're doing. Holding their breath is a phrase that I've heard many times over this last week from Irish and from friends in Europe, too. I was quoting the Secretary General of the NATO alliance a moment ago. I think it's very clear that all members of that alliance are just keeping their fingers crossed and hoping that things do change dramatically and with the departure of the leader who was so dismissive himself of NATO as an alliance. I think they're all hoping for a major change with the Biden administration. They're anxious to not appear to be over-optimistic, however. I think that one of the things that they're eager to, or at least anxious to ensure amongst all, as they go about all their own internal discussions and assessments of how things are likely to go, they don't want to build up expectations too high of the Biden administration. I think they are sympathetic, and they sense that he's going to have a lot on his plate, and they're not expecting things to get radically better, radically quicker, quickly.
You know, sitting here talking to you now as we get set to inaugurate Joe Biden, I bring us back to when Donald Trump was running for president and the people he surrounded himself, Stephen Miller, Steve Bannon, and all those other people. You have to remember part of what their change was is they wanted to. Donald Trump and his associates, when they got in the White House and they got control of the Republican, they got control of the House and the Senate, they part of their plan, and they admitted it, was to tear things down, to tear what the fabric of our government down. And had they gotten another second term, they would have been successful in tearing it down and then rebuilding it in a totally different image. I know I sound like I'm reaching for something there, but if you look back at the words and the plans that were talked about, it was about tearing down the way the government operates.
Sure. I mean, Trump has always intended to be a major disruptor, and disruption was a favorite word. I mean, it's become a word of approbation since it became so popular in Silicon Valley, especially. I remember the head of Facebook himself saying that his main policy was to move fast and break things. And although they couldn't be more different people, I think the president of the United States for the last four years was very much in that mold too: move fast and break things, without very much thought about what the long term view might be for that, and the likely outcome, the unexpected outcome, the unwanted results of major disruption. Europe is having its own taste of disruption now, certainly in the British Isles here, the country of Ireland, which remains in Europe, and Britain, which has now left Europe in Brexit. And that word again is coming up there with a lot greater negative ring to it. Huge disruption, I see, is the headline today in an article in the Irish Times. And that's because the trucking companies of Ireland have discovered that going across the border now and importing material across the sea from Britain, now that it's no longer part of Europe, is a lot more complicated than was expected. Now that we've got an actual border between Britain and Ireland again, thanks to Brexit, you're getting these predictions by the trucking companies that there will be disappearing supply chains, they say, and empty supermarket shelves. It's already starting to happen to some degree, and there's a lot of concern about that. This is major disruption to ordinary people's lives, and it wasn't bargained for. And now we're finding some of the practical. We're seeing full up and close on. Some of the practical results of that extraordinary change that we experienced as our example this side of the Atlantic of a major disruption, and a leader, of course, in the shape of Boris Johnson, who wanted to go in for wholesale disruption in a kind of echo of Trump as well.
You know, looking around, there's other elections, and it looks like the United States is going to have to be quiet about what's going on in Uganda, because we have our own mess here. But Uganda once again finds themselves in a mess where the defeated candidate claims voter fraud and has video proof of it. But the Uganda elections, something normally that the United States could chime in with some confidence on, we can't. That's the position we are in now in a country.
Well, exactly. The beacon of the liberal democracy is somewhat dimmed now. And Uganda is a bad case of big man politics again, of the kind that liberal democracies have always wanted to express concern about and urge change upon. The United States of America, in particular, has had a track record of, well, it's been mixed, but at times they've been very solid. The United States diplomats have been very solid in the continent of Africa in urging democracy as the way forward for African countries. And and President Museveni in Uganda was something of a darling of the United States and of the entire global economic system. The World Bank, I think, ended up looking as if its absolute favorite country in Africa was Uganda. And that's not the case now. Museveni is looking less palatable to the rest of the world, and Bobby Wine, as a very popular figure in many ways, a musician with enormous following, has decided to challenge Museveni, who's been in power for so long now, and of course, as always with big man politics, the system has been geared to guarantee the success of the big man again. As Bobby Wine can only point out, as best he can, the faults in the electoral process, and hope that the international community will support him. But with America in the state that it's in, he's unlikely to get that global support.
I want to go one other place. This is an interesting story, and that is what happened with the Dutch government, how they resigned in mass. This is the second time, I think, since 2000. What happened was the Dutch government accused thousands of families, wrongly, by the way, of child welfare fraud, and they were told to pay it back. And this has been such a disaster. The whole government has resigned in mass.
Yes, well, there's a great sense of communal responsibility, cabinet responsibility, it's called in Britain, and governmental responsibility shared in the Netherlands. And it's an instructive lesson in accountability. It's an interesting fact that when things go wrong, people at the top, the old phrase in Truman's White House was "the buck stops here," and it's an instructive example of politicians, in this case, en masse, you know, as an entire group, taking responsibility. And we can contrast that perhaps with the United States chief executive wanting to avoid responsibility at just about every turn over the last 4 years.
And one
the
final...
interesting thing is that Ireland too has its case of giving money with one hand and taking it away with another. By the way, they're in an embarrassing position now of asking people to pay their taxes on a major COVID stimulus payment that went out to Irish citizens last year. The Irish government now is trying to claw some of that back by imposing a tax upon it. I wonder how that's going to play out in the long term. I think the Dutch example of those welfare payments, wrongly accused of being illegal and excessive, that might be instructive for the Irish treatment of their COVID stimulus payment recipients.
And we often talk about the difference between being white and a person of color in this country, but the BBC just released their investigation, and it has uncovered there what we have found out is here, and that is, if you're young and black and you're a Muslim, you're more likely to die.
Well, such is life. It's appalling, and it needs to be underlined every time information becomes clear about that. It needs to be underlined and broadcast firmly. The BBC is doing its job again. I think, on the whole, the job is reporting on race relations and injustices of a racial kind, and Britain's population of color is, of course, of a different makeup. Yep. From the United States, but the similarities in terms of inequity between races and racial groupings is every bit as serious and needs to be reported every bit as seriously.
It's interesting. As I was growing up as a teenager in high school, and I was in a black it was a black club that was formed by John Mahoney, who became a principal in our high school. And one of the books he had that I read was Black Like Me, and it really stood out that the difference of the color of your skin, whether it's brown, red, or whatever color it is, in America, and it's still, obviously, this is not hidden anymore. There are a lot of Americans that feel that if you don't have a white skin, you are not the same as them, and that's something. I'm 68 years old. We haven't overcome that in my 68 years, and I just don't know when we'll have to become a white minority country, I think, for that really to take hold.
Well, the change has certainly been slow and appallingly creeping. What change there has been? It's perfectly reasonable to argue that it's been insufferably slow. I am interested in you in dating it the way that you did, Marshall, because I read that same book, Black Like Me. In a small library in a small town in England, and it had a powerful effect on me. It essentially turned me into the kind of person who wanted to do the kind of journalism that I ended up doing. The comparisons between the populations, as I say, would indicate that there's different in type and in historical origins, but essentially the impact is the same, and I think the psychology is the same too. It is shocking how much skin color makes a difference to the ways of thinking of the majority population in our respective countries. It's shocking and insupportable, and yet, of course, it is woven into the tapestry of our makeup.
Well, unfortunately, we'll have to wrap it up here. We'll see what happens by the time we reach next week and Joe Biden is president. David, are you coming? Are you over there for one more week, or are you heading back?
I'm here for the duration. I'll be here for some time now.
All right. Well,
it's getting more and more interesting, and there's a lot more to report on. I'll be coming back to you each week with it.
All right, David. We'll speak to you next week.
Good. I'll look forward to it.
All right. David Terachuk with the Media Beat here this morning on Robinhood Radio.